to start a podcast, and it's like the biggest Bitcoin podcast in the world. Not enough. I've got to start a football team. No, not enough. I've got to buy a bar. No, not enough. I've got to become an MP. I've got to fix my local town. We as Bitcoiners, we know exactly what's happening. We know exactly what's going on. We're trying to tell everyone. My ego required success and money, and that meant I hurt people that loved me, and I think about that a lot. I used to have this spreadsheet where I had every shitcoin, its value in pounds, dollars, and Bitcoin. But there are people in the world of Bitcoin, billionaires, and I think they could have stepped up and helped people, but for whatever reason, they chose not to. As hard as this interview is, because you're making me really be vulnerable and open up, it's nice to have this conversation. And if I just vote for that party, that one's going to fix it, and they don't realize it is a feature, not a bug. It is how the system of incentives works.
I'm more curious right now about what you dream when you go to sleep.
All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy.
Welcome to Learn Bitcoin, Pete. I'm excited to talk to you about Bitcoin, everything you've built, and what's next. But first, let's clear the air. You interviewed Mike Peterson a couple of times way before I did. Your first interview was episode 179.
Was that what it was?
Yeah, I checked it. Mine was episode 12. Now, please read what he said after sitting down with me.
Hands down, my favorite podcast interview I've ever participated in. I had never ever heard of Peter McCormack when I agreed. I had never even heard of All In Bitcoin Pod when I agreed to the interview, but the questions CK asked were the personal and challenging. Definitely not just another Bitcoin podcast. Excited to check out her other interviews. Well, I've got a couple of thoughts on that. Firstly, I'm excited by your personal and challenging questions. Do you know the background to my interview with him? Do you know I met him in Uruguay?
No.
So I went out to Le Bitconf.
I know you interviewed him when no one knew anything about Mike Peters or El Salvador, for that matter.
Nothing at all. I think I was probably like one of the first people to go there. So what happened was I was at Le Bitconf in Uruguay, and I was stood outside the conference venue, and he came up to me. I think he was with his son, and he said, I've got this project in El Salvador. And I was like, okay, yeah, tell me about it. He said, yeah, it's called Bitcoin Beach. It's in a place called El Zonte. Someone's given us some Bitcoin and we use it to help people locally and we accept Bitcoin. And I was like, sounds cool. Can I see it? And he said, yeah. So I went straight on my phone, looked up the flights to El Salvador. I think I had to go via Panama. And 2 days later, I was in El Salvador. I was down in El Zonte with him looking at his project, having some pupusa.
Okay.
And then obviously after that, everything went wild in El Salvador. But that was I think Bukele was in power at that point. But, you know, Jack Mallers hadn't been, the whole Bitcoin project hadn't started. It was him at a beach. I mean, I thought I did a good interview with Michael. And if he says yours was the best and the questions were personal and challenging, I'm excited.
Okay, let's just start with my 21 takes on you and let's take it from there. Ready?
Your takes on me?
Yeah, 21 takes on you.
Wow, okay.
Okay.
Here we go.
You've got a big heart. What does it come from?
My big heart?
Yeah.
Oh. I don't know if you ever know. Why do you say I have a big heart?
Because I have followed you since the very beginning. So I think you have a huge heart. I think you are generous. I think you see the good in people.
I think I'm just being who I am. It's nature, nurture. My mother would have played a huge role in that. She had a huge heart. She trained to be a nurse in her 40s and decided that's what she wanted to do because she wanted to help kids and look after kids. And she also worked for a charity for the church called St. Vincent de Paul, where, I don't know, a woman who's left her husband and has been just moved into a temporary accommodation, or immigrants had come into the town and they didn't have any furniture. She would help them get furniture. And I used to see her do that. So perhaps it came from my mum, because my mum never cared about money. She never gave a damn about money. She cared about people. I think that's probably rubbed off on me.
Were you always a bit of a troublemaker?
Yes, I was always a bit of a trouble. I'm the youngest of three. My brother and sister were born a year apart. 4 years later, my dad had a few beers. Took a look at my mum, accidentally made me in Cyprus. And so trying to compete with an older brother and sister, I was like the little rebel kid, rock and roll kid, punk rock kid. And yeah, I've always been a troublemaker. Yeah.
Okay, so what two out of these six qualities make someone most British? Must be able to huddle massive amount of liquor. Must curse creatively and at all times. Apologize for everything. Bad teeth, but deeply sorry about it. Secretly believe tea solves actual emergencies and hangovers, and best world-class humor ever.
Well, the world-class humor, of course.
Yeah, of course.
I think it's all six. How can I choose between a perfect description of British people in six takes? I think the Irish are better with the liquor.
Okay.
I am half Irish as well. and we do swear a lot. For YouTube, you need to not swear for the first 15 minutes. So I'm trying to not swear for the first 15 minutes of any interview I give or do. I think you've missed one.
Which one?
We are very civil in the way we queue up.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we see a queue and we just join it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, look, we swear a lot. T-souls. I'm going to go
you
with...
You apologize for everything.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I think we're just quite civil people. Although I think that's going at the moment. Life is hard. I think people are starting to get a little bit sick mm-hmm. of what's happening, and people are losing their temper a little bit over things. But I would say I'm going to go with tea solves everything. Any argument, you can pause, say, let's have a cup of tea, and that solves something. And
it's humor.
And I think we are the funniest people in the world. It's the thing I miss the most when I leave the UK. You see, in America, Americans aren't very funny. And the annoying thing about is that their humor is they think they're funny, but they're not funny. And they don't understand sarcasm or irony. It's very brash, like just shout in your face humor. And it's not funny. And so when I'm in America, I find it painful hanging around with Americans when they think they're being funny. And then I will say the most amazing joke. And then inside I have to just laugh to myself because it completely passes them by.
Do you see parts of your dad in how you are today?
Huh. If you'd have asked me that a few years ago, I said no, because me and my dad are very different.
Mm-hmm.
My dad is very safe, risk averse, very careful with money, whereas I'm a lunatic. I take endless risks and financial risks, career risks, and I accept what will be. But my dad also did work very hard. He put a work ethic into me. He wanted me to go to a private school and have a good education. He thought education was the most important thing. And he could not afford to send me to private school on his salary as an aircraft engineer, which was 4 days on, 4 days off, 12-hour shifts. But in those 4 days off, if there was overtime, he would accept every single time, which means he just worked endlessly. And I got that work ethic from him. But what was interesting about my dad is that as he retired, he just chilled out a lot, became very relaxed, non-confrontational, very soft, very gentle towards people. And there's parts of me I sense that's coming. And I wonder where it comes from sometimes. I think perhaps it's, I mean, for me personally, whether you're religious or not, we all wonder what's next. It's one of two things. It's nothingness forever mm-hmm. or something. And if it's something, well, we've been raised to think there may be a judgment on who we are, which puts you in a position of some existential perspective and spiritual perspective on life. And, you know, we defer things in life. For me, the diet always starts tomorrow.
Okay.
And then I go to my coffee shop and I have a chocolate croissant. It's like, okay, it's another day. And I think sometimes we defer some of our decisions, perhaps what are moral decisions, we defer them and think we can repent later in life. But I think when you face death, I think if you were struck down with a terminal illness, you have now a ticking time clock. And I assume people make very quick changes to their lives. One, with regards to how they use their time.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, with how they behave and the decisions they make. And I was thinking about this the other day. Is why would you defer being a good person? Why would you defer how you consider your time and until a point where you're faced with looking at death in the face. And so I'm myself starting to think a lot more about like how I use my time and my and the decisions I make and whether there's any harm that comes from decisions I've made or do make. And I'm trying to make less of them now. And I think that that makes you a more gentler, slower, still person. And I think that's what I see from my dad in me now. It's a long answer to a simple question.
It's a great answer. What is it like to be a father?
Oh, that's a really good question.
I have plenty of them.
It's not really a Bitcoin interview, is it? It's a life interview.
21 takes on you and then Bitcoin hits.
I mean, being a father is incredible and hard. It's the best thing in the world and the biggest pain in the ass. It's a constant challenge. You never stop being a father. My dad, I still turn to him for things now. He's his late 70s and I'm in my late 40s and he's always 30 years ahead of me and he's got 30 years of wisdom more than me on certain things. We have a problem. We have a problem in the world that you and I are really acutely aware of, which is inflation and a financial system that is designed to extract from the poorest and the middle class and to give to the richest in society, which is why we buy Bitcoin. But so fragile is the world's financial system now, and so late are we in this kind of debt cycle that you really start to think about the world you're leaving for your kids, and we are leaving a much worse world. American Hodel said this. He said, money is a proxy for time. You earn money to save, so you can buy time to do other things, to give yourself optionality. But if we as a, and I say the collective we, as a country, take on debt, we are actively stealing from our kids' future. And when you think about that, how cowardly is that? For us as humans to say to our kids, I want stuff now, so you are going to pay for it in the future. I mean, it's cowardly. I would never do that to my own children. I build up a life for me and hope to leave them more than I've had to give them a better life and better options and better choices, more freedom. And I think most parents want to do that for their children, but collectively as a society, we don't do that. We consume from their future to have what we want now. And that is, to me, is pure cowardice. And so I feel like I think about my job as a parent, but I also think of our jobs, our generation. We have a collective parental job for the collective future of our children. And we are doing a terrible job. We are doing a terrible job. I wish I'd had more children. I have two. I wish I'd had more. I regret that. Probably my biggest regret in life. And
why is that?
Because, you know, like last night, we went to the shops and we got home and I cooked a Sunday roast. I don't cook often. Mm-hmm. And the kids had been making fun of the last Christmas dinner I made a year ago, saying it was rubbish. I was like, no, it's good. It's good. I was like, screw you. I'm going to prove it. And so I made Sunday dinner. It took me 3 hours. And because I'm there at the kitchen making the dinner, we're all kind of hanging around talking, having fun, and then we all sit and eat together. Whereas if we go to a pub and have dinner, the conversations are slightly different because we all sat together the whole meal. You're forced into the conversation. Whereas when you're making the meal, you're all a bit mobile around the room, doing your own things, dipping in and out of conversations. And we just had really good time together. Like it's quite special to just spend that time. If I hadn't have cooked dinner, maybe I'd have ordered a takeaway and would have sat with it on our lap in front of the TV and watched football. But we didn't. We were together as a family.
What's the process for turning the next generation into builders? Not heirs, but into builders.
It's education, really. And it's more than education. You've got to give them something to believe in, an inspiration. I remember leaving school and being excited about the world, that I could go and get a job and create a business and buy a home. And I was excited by the world. Mobile phones were very new. There was texts and calls. The internet was an exciting new frontier. And I think what the kids can face now is very different. They've been raised on mobile phones and social media, and their peer group isn't the other kids who live on the same street as them, as the ones they go to school with. Their peer group is the entire world. So whereas we saw the kid at school who was maybe the better runner, who was better at chemistry or math, they see the kid who's 20 years old and drives a Lamborghini and lives in Dubai, or the girl who dances on TikTok and is a multimillionaire, or a girl who goes on to bloody OnlyFans and makes millions of pounds. And that creates a pressure to be something that's unachievable for the vast majority of kids now. And then the reality of what's in front of them is, like, can I make a life as a multimillionaire doing something on this phone? Or do I do something locally in my community? And what can I do? Where can I work? What opportunities exist?
I remember when Connor started working at what Bitcoin did and then left. So I'm curious about that process to turn next generation, your kids, into builders, because that's a worry.
Well, nepotism helps.
Mm-hmm.
He and I went out to Malaysia earlier last year. I met up with Balaji, and we went for a walk with Balaji around Forest City where we were. And Balaji made this very interesting point. I was explaining how Connor's quit university and is working with me. And he said, you're basically doing what happened, you know, a century or two ago, where Connor's come to work on the farm. You're the farmer. He's come to work on the farm. And the reason this is good is, well, he's half your DNA, and you can imprint on him what you think are important values. And so he will get to create a life based on that experience with you. It's better than a university experience. And it's a fair point, because university is, I think, largely considered a scam now. You get a huge amount of debt with no guarantee of job at the end of it. Whereas Connor has no debt. He has a job, he has skills, he's mobile, he's financially secure. And he's had that because he's had to work with me. But he's in that fortunate position. How many kids have got that?
Yeah.
And so how do you inspire a generation to be builders? I think you just have to set them a good example. And I don't think we're doing that right now. I would hate to be a kid right now. They've got every opportunity in front of them, and everything just feels so hard and distant. I mean, how are most kids these days meant to afford to get on the property ladder? I mean, it's virtually impossible. So it's tough.
What makes a good partner?
Good partner? You don't mean business partner, do you?
Not necessarily, but it's up to you.
I don't think I make a good partner.
Because?
I prioritize the wrong things. It cost me my marriage. So I don't really know what makes a good partner, because I've never really been a good partner myself. I think I'm a difficult person to be in a relationship with, because I have ADHD, so I can't switch off. I'm always thinking about how I can save the world. And I'm always reading or watching things or listening to things and consuming the information and knowledge and trying to process it. And I think if you want to be in a relationship with somebody, it's about being a partner, as you say, use that word, a team, creating a team that takes on the world. And I've never really done that. I've gone solo. And probably when I've had that person with me, not spent enough time thinking about, well, what does the world mean for them and what do they want? And supporting them in what they want to do. I've always just been tunnel vision on mine. It's like, you join me for the ride I'm on, or see you later. Something even my kids had to adapt to. But I am in that really reflective period of my life where that recognition of understanding what ADHD means for an adult helped me understand why I keep starting businesses and doing things and creating movements and never really finishing them. And so I've started to slow down. I've started to switch off some of the things I was doing, because I'd rather actually just spend time with my kids. And so in doing that, perhaps over the next year or so, I may be the kind of person who would make a good partner, because I've understood my own priorities are wrong. So So I don't know. I don't think I've been a very good partner to anyone.
What were your obsessions growing up?
Oh, good. Good question. Music. Mm-hmm. I was obsessed by music.
I understand.
Rock and roll, heavy metal. I started a fanzine when I was 15. I'd go around and interview bands, which was really cool. I'd turn up at concerts and be on the guest list. I interviewed Korn, Skunk Anansie, Pantera, Slayer. It was amazing. I used to get all my CDs for free. I was obsessed with music, just obsessed. Skateboarding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I used to just finish school on a Friday, get a skateboard, and Lurk Street car park behind here. You know the car park behind here?
No.
On the street behind here where we are, Lurk Street car park, we used to go up to the fifth floor. And when we had cars and we were driving, we'd park up the car, we'd stick on some punk, and we would skateboard for an hour, 2 hours, and then go to a club called Esquires and rock out. I was obsessed with that, and I was obsessed with making money. I didn't have a poor life, but my dad's put all his money into schooling, and I wanted money, so I just worked. So I had paper rounds and a milk round and worked in a factory, worked in a local shop, anything I could to earn money. I was obsessed with making money.
Was football a big thing at home back then?
I loved football. I wasn't a very good player. So I love football. I've always liked football. Became more of an obsession as an adult. But that wasn't an obsession with football as such. That's an obsession with trying to ensure my local town as a team that's successful. So it's more about the community. And we are one of the largest towns in the country that's never had a professional team. And I was like, well, how do we make that happen?
A childhood lesson that still shapes your decisions today.
So I was obsessed with money. I wanted to make money. My dad had a friend, a successful friend, a guy called Keith Mason, sadly died a couple of years ago. But he was the successful guy in my dad's community of friends. He had the big house, his own business. And we were on holiday in Cyprus once a year, and he was there. And I must have been about 14 years old. And I said to him, I remember asking him, I said to him, yeah, what's it like to sack somebody? I was, like The Apprentice, you're fired. I asked him all excited, and he said to me, Pete, listen, sacking somebody is one of the hardest things you ever have to do, because when you do, that person might have a wife, kids, a home, and you've taken away from them their income. And at the point they don't have their income, you've introduced instability into their life. And that's, I don't remember his words exactly, but it was along these lines. And it really hit me hard. And so I've always been worried about other people's financial position. And so when I make decisions, I, like any of my businesses, if it costs somebody a job, I dwell on it a lot. I think about it a lot. And maybe that's part of like your heart question. I do worry about other people's finances. Right now, the global economy, the economy here in the UK, I am planning to protect myself, knowing other people are going to get absolutely screwed. That lives with me. That really kind of unsettles me.
What's your most expensive mistake?
There's so many ways you can answer that. Like, you can answer that financially. Buying a bar was an expensive mistake.
And emotionally?
I think the most expensive mistake I made was not loving my wife enough, because it cost me my marriage. And then cost me my family being a unit. I took it for granted. I was very selfish, focused on myself and my career. And ultimately, she didn't want anything to do with that anymore. And it's a really weird thing, because it fundamentally changed my life. My company collapsed afterwards. My health went. I became a drug addict. I hit what you would call rock bottom. I nearly went bankrupt. And then I stopped. I went running for a year. Chance meeting of a podcaster called Rich Roll. Started a podcast. Discovered Bitcoin. Made some good money. Bought a football club. And now I can functionally retire if I want to. So weirdly, it kind of changed the direction of my life professionally in the most amazing, incredible way. I've got to travel the world, been to 50 countries with this podcast. I've made documentaries. I've met so many incredible people. But the cost was my marriage and my family, and that's never left me. I still think about it most days with a huge amount of regret, primarily because I wasn't a good person. I just wasn't a nice person at all. I was so obsessed with success and making money and whatever trauma that is about, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's because I went to a private school and my dad couldn't afford it and I was surrounded by rich kids and wanted to prove myself. Maybe it's because I was just the youngest of three and wanted to prove myself. But whatever it is, my ego required success and money, and that meant I hurt people that loved me, and I think about that a lot.
What's one stupid risk you took that actually paid off?
Taking copious amounts of cocaine, mm-hmm. which led me to a website called The Silk Road, which led me to Bitcoin. I mean, taking drugs, each time you snort cocaine, you're taking a risk with your life. You can die, you know, and you're becoming a drug user, mm-hmm. and eventually for me, a drug addict. So that was a huge risk. But I discovered Bitcoin, which changed my life. Another one was just for no reason at all, I just decided to attend a yoga retreat in Italy after I separated from my wife, because it was run by this podcast that I was listening to. I was like, I think I need to be at this yoga retreat. So I went to it, met the guy and became friends with him and started a podcast. Going out to Italy to be at a yoga retreat with a bunch of people I didn't know, a bunch of vegans, was a risk. But I think the biggest risk I'm going to take is ahead of me in that I have a need to go through an ego death. I've got an ego and I have a need to go through that. And I'm kind of going through it at the moment. And with that, it's a risk because what I'm doing is refocusing myself so that I can maximize the time I have with my family and the people I love, which means sacrificing maybe some of my ambitions. And that's a risk, but maybe that will pay off.
Are you ready to sacrifice some of your ambitions?
I've been doing it recently. I've been cutting things out of my life, selling businesses I have and saying no to things that I want to do. I've been offered the opportunity to become an MP.
Yeah.
I mean, what an incredible thing. Honor to would be if I was to run and just say I had a chance of winning to become MP, say, for Bedford. That would be a huge honor and commitment, and you'd be in the Houses of Parliament and you would be one of the 650 people who get to govern this country. In terms of ambition, it'd be incredible, and you are near the levers of power, but the cost of that would be less time with my children, and I'm not willing to make that sacrifice. So I think the bigger risks are the ones now.
Your children are going to leave the nest.
Yeah, I know, but I can still be a father from distance, even if they leave the nest. If they need me, I want to be able to go, okay, I'm there.
Mm-hmm. You need to have the time.
Yeah, but also, I'm reading a lot at the moment. I'm reading so many different books at the same time, just old, wise books. I'm near the end of Dante's Inferno. I'm halfway through rereading Bastiat's The Law. I've just downloaded Machiavelli's The Prince. I intend to go back and read The Odyssey, The Iliad, and The Aeneid books I read as a kid. There's so much wisdom in these old books. And when you look at how society is at the moment, I want to have the kind of the wisdom and knowledge so that if my kids need some kind of guidance, it's not from me guessing what's going on in the world, but just standing on the shoulders of giants who warned us about all of this.
What's something you dream of?
Oh, man. Oh, so if I told you what I dream of.
Yes.
Do you mean I actually dream? The dreams I have when I go to sleep or my ambition dreams?
I'm more curious right now about what you dream when you go to sleep.
Gosh, if I told you that, it'd be so embarrassing. No, I'll tell you afterwards.
Okay.
But I do have recurring dreams whereby I can't complete a task. I'll tell you the funny one. I had a dream once. I was in the British Open Golf and I was winning. And we get to the final tee. Do you understand golf, what I mean by tee?
A little
the
bit.
The last hole. So you put the ball on to strike it. It's the final fairway I've got to hit down and I'm winning. And I put the ball on the tee and it falls off. And every time I try and put the ball back on the tee, it falls off and it keeps falling off. And like everyone's like saying to me, Pete, come on, come on. And I just can't get the ball on the tee. And everyone just leaves. And I've had so many dreams like that where I'm near to something and I cannot complete the task. It's kind of a bit like my ADHD.
And what do you think it means?
That I don't complete things. Because that's true. I don't complete things. I just move from one thing to the next thing. I get bored very quickly and have to do... I start a podcast and it's like the biggest Bitcoin podcast in the world. No, not enough. I've got to start a football team. No, not enough. I've got to buy a bar. No, not enough. I've got to become an MP. I've got to fix my local town. And it's just like, I don't finish things. And it's like, what is going on there? What is this constant need to prove something? But I've stopped it. Like I said, I've kind of got to that point where I was like, I don't need to do that anymore. And I don't know if I've had one of those dreams recently.
Are you in therapy right now?
No, I tried it. I did try it after my divorce, but it just didn't work for me.
Okay.
No, I'm very good at living in the present right now. I used to have anxiety, which we know anxiety is a worry about the future. Depression is worry about the past. I have neither. I'm very peaceful and happy and content right now. I have, a perfect day to me is, like today's a good day, right? I get up, get my daughter ready for school, drop her off. Go and have a cup of coffee and do a bit of writing. I'm here having a lovely conversation with you. I'm going to go back. I'm probably going to play tennis with my son. Then I'm going to pick my daughter up. I'm going to make dinner and we're going to have dinner together. That's living in the present. If I'm worried about the future, I'm not going to have that tennis game with my son because I'm going to be working. And yeah, maybe I'd order a takeaway and we'd sit there and then I'll get my laptop out and start working again. And there's a funny thing about money. I think most people want to make good money. Mm-hmm. Most people are like, oh, I'd love to be a millionaire. I want to make money. And my thesis on money is quite simple. It's like being broke sucks. Like not being able to afford to pay your rent, feed your kids, that sucks. Nobody wants to be in that position. It's awful. Worrying about money all the time sucks. But once you get to a certain position, it's not rich. You get to the point whereby you don't have to worry about day to day. You might not realize it, but you are rich because you have control over your time. You don't have to worry. Everything after that is a lump. The Lamborghini is just a lump. A bigger house is a lump. People get yachts and they're just lumps. It's like, when have you got enough? And none of them actually bring, like, I love cars, don't get me wrong. And I've had Porsche, Aston Martin, Lamborghini. I've always just wanted, that's always been like the goal, the next car I want. I can live without it. I would much rather just play tennis or read a book or hang out with my family. And that's a recent thing I've discovered, which is maybe where some of my ambition has gone from because, I don't know. I can't remember. What was the question again?
Something you dream of.
Do you know what? I mean, I've told you what I dream of in terms of like that weird not being able to finish something. But ambition dreams, I don't have any anymore. Be a granddad?
Be a granddad.
Yeah, I cannot wait for the day. And I don't want them to do it yet.
Cannot wait.
But my son's like, he's early 20. If he came home one day and said, I'd be over the moon. I look forward to being able to help my kids with their kids. I look forward to be able to wake up with no commitments at all. Just get up and be able to read and write and maybe just help other people. I'd like to be able to do things for other people now.
It's great. You're in a great position.
Yeah, honestly, it's quite reflective time, but yeah, I've never achieved anything truly incredible and I'm very content with life now. I always thought ambition was about reaching for something. But actually, I realized for me, it was about running away from something, from the personal battle you have with your own ego.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, I can only speak for me, but I've become content by very small little things, like making dinner last night with the kids. When you realize what does really make you happy, like when are you truly happy? The gift of my divorce was, I've had two really weird gifts. When I explain their gifts, I mean their gifts because if you look at them and accept the perspective that comes with it, they can teach you something. So my divorce was hugely painful. It was a horrible thing to go through. But it was also a gift in that I ended up taking a year off work. I didn't do anything for a year. I ran every day. I was coming off drugs and trying to get my act together. And I was suffering with like chronic anxiety, couldn't get out of bed. And I'd gone to the doctor and they wanted to put me on antidepressants and I didn't want that. So I went and bought some trainers and just started running. And I ran every day. The river down. Have you seen the river?
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I used to run up and down the river 10 kilometers a day and a half marathon a week. And I'd go home and I'd have nothing to do. And so I'd try and find things to do. And it might be like clear up a drawer or clear up a room. And then I'd have nothing to do. So I started going to the gym and I'd do whatever was on at the gym. I was doing Pilates with old women and yoga and whatever. And then suddenly I started to get busy again. But I was busy with the choices I wanted, like how I would spend my time. And that was a huge gift. And the second gift is going to sound super weird, but when my mum died, she had cancer. And there's only one good thing about cancer is that it gives you time. Like if my dad passed away, say he has a heart attack, it's going to be that. You're just going to get a phone call and that's it. He's gone. But when somebody gets cancer, you have a, it's awful. Don't get me wrong. Anyone listening, I'm not saying cancer's cool in any way at all. But you get the gift of time if you choose to accept it. So when my mum had cancer, she was living in Ireland. If she'd have died at the age she died, which was 67, I actually think, what's the date today?
January 12th.
Yeah, I think today is the 9th anniversary of her death. I'm pretty sure it was the January the 12th she died. And because they were living in Ireland, I'd see them once or twice a year. So say she'd had a heart attack. From the period we found out she'd had cancer, that I'd have seen her six times. Because she had cancer, I was seeing her twice a month. So I got to spend a lot more time with my mum because of that. And the only gift of that is that appreciation of time with the people you love. There's this really good website called, I think it's called Wait But Why. And it's got this chart and it says, how many times a year do you see your parents? What's the average age they live to? This is how many more times you're going to see them. And you look at the number and it's something weird like 9 or 12. And you're like, holy crap, I'm only going to see my parents 12 more times. And so when you get that perspective, you want to spend more time with them. And the perspective I got from that a long way down the line is I just want to spend more time with my kids. I want to maximize the time I have with them. And so ambition, for me, it's a false god in that what is it you're trying to do and what do you think it's going to do for you when you get there? So I start a Bitcoin podcast. It ends up becoming the biggest in the world. I can get nearly any Bitcoin interview I want. It pays good money. It's just the most incredible life. And when I got there, and what? I'm in Texas in an Airbnb and my kids are here in the UK and I'm not with them. And when I come back, I'm busy. Like, what actually does it mean? What? Because some people say, wow, you've done a great job. Can I have a photo? And it's like, but what does that actually mean? Does it, like, where does happiness come from? Does happiness come from people saying, you've done a great job? I mean, how many times do you hear that? And it's meaningless.
You've done it. You've done a good job.
But it's kind of meaningless.
Yeah, I understand.
Like, again, when are you truly happy? Driving my daughter to school this morning and we're listening to punk rock. We're listening to a band called Pierce the Veil and singing together. That's a great moment. I'm happy. And when I'm sat in my coffee shop and I'm having a coffee, I'm happy. As hard as this interview is, because you're making me really be vulnerable and open up to a bunch of people who are going to make fun of me on online, I'm still, it's nice to have this conversation. And when I go and play tennis with my son, it's going to be great. We're going to run around. We're going to he's going to probably win and I'm going to, yeah, be out of breath and tired. But again, I'm going to be enjoying it. And then I'm going to pick up my daughter and we're going to go and make dinner. And it's great. And like in the moment, it feels good because you're enjoying what you're doing. And that's not to say building that podcast, I had so many great moments. That's a lot of sacrifices though. And so my relationship with ambition is I'm going to try and live day to day doing the things that make me happy. And if with that success comes and that has some benefits, then great. Like my podcast now, if I wanted to have 2 million downloads next month, I know how to do it. I know which people to interview, which topics and how to trigger people. But actually, me and my son drive to London to the studio to make the interview. So each day we do that. We leave at 8 in the morning. We get back at 6, 7 o'clock and I'm tired. And so you kind of lose a day. And the time in the car with him is great because we talk about stuff. But I said to him, we could build that studio we have, that beautiful studio in London. We could build something. It's not going to be as cool or fancy, but we could build one in the house. And then if we're talking about something, want to make a show, we can just go in that room and make it and we lose an hour. We don't lose a whole day. And that means we can get to do more of the stuff we want to do.
Quality of time.
Yeah, my ambition is tied to maximizing the years I have left, doing the things I want to do. And if benefits come off the back of that, great. And if I wither away and nobody remembers me, then so be it. As long as I'm doing the things I want to do each day. This is such a deep interview.
I know.
I know why he said that now.
So you like showing off. Has that ever got you in trouble?
Yes, it has. It has, but I am becoming more introverted. Yeah. Again, I think ambition and showing off for me were correlated. Again, it was just all about ego, trying to prove myself to the world. I can be somebody. And that ties probably back to my failure of my marriage. We go to a party and I'd try and be the center of attention, the funny guy telling the stories and shit, and just leave her in the background and forgot about her. Neglected. Got me in trouble there. Probably a lot of people on Twitter think I'm a dick. The funny thing about Twitter is it's a bit like in business. I always say to people who work for me, don't have important conversations over text because you can't hear the tone, the context of people are saying things. So you might read it as rude and it's actually polite. And I think Twitter's like that sometimes. I'm like, when I'm like writing something, I'm cracking up and thinking it's funny. And if somebody reads it, it might just look like really rude. Yeah.
What's the worst thing I could do to you?
The worst thing you could do to me? I mean, I could think of some awful things, but I don't think we need to go there. The worst thing you could do to me?
To me, I value loyalty.
Have you read Dante's Inferno?
No.
So I'm just reading it now because I was listening to an interview between Mike Cernovich and Tucker Carlson, and he mentions it. And it's about the journey through hell. And there's 9 rings of hell. Before you get to hell, there's an era of limbo for the cowards, which I think about a lot. But the final ring of hell, the deepest part of hell, is reserved for the treacherous people. And so for Judas, I'm not there yet because I haven't finished the book, but as I understand it, Judas is in, he's there and they're frozen in a lake. And the deeper the treachery, the deeper you are in the lake. And I think Satan gnaws on you. So yeah, treachery, you know, it's something disloyal. I don't think you could do something so disloyal to me, unless you AI'd this to say things I didn't say. But if you're asking generally what's the word, not you personally, I think, yeah, disloyalty. Yeah, and I think about disloyalty in 2 ways. Someone can be disloyal to you, but you can be disloyal to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a form of treachery that we all should try and face. Like not getting in shape, I'm being disloyal to myself. I'm being disloyal to this body I've been given.
Mm-hmm.
And I am increasing my chances of dying younger than necessary because I don't look after my health.
The secret behind making friends.
Well, I've made friends and enemies. Well, I mean, making friends and keeping friends is 2 different things. I mean, making friends, there's just something where when something clicks with somebody and you get on well with them. Like I met a guy on an airplane once, a guy called Justin, who actually came up with the name What Bitcoin Did, by the way. And we just clicked and we became friends and we stayed friends. But I think loyalty goes in there. Just always being there for somebody, them knowing you're always there and that you will be there.
Can you tell me a story of decay you witnessed in your own circle, one that really taught you?
Decay. My mother was diagnosed with stage 3B ovarian cancer. So I watched her body decay to the point of death. I was there in the hospital. I popped home and she died after I popped back to my dad's. And I watched that and I saw her body give up. I saw her get frail and regularly need to be going back and forth to hospital and then be in hospital permanently and then die. So I've seen that. Do you want to hear the most incredible thing? So in Ireland, if you die, they bury you within 2 days. They don't muck around. And the body, they leave the body in the house in an open casket. Like, my mum was just there in an open casket. We're all having cheese sandwiches and drinking beer and doing what the Irish do. And then we get up in the morning to take her to the church for the service. Anyway, we carry her down, put her in the car, get in the car, turn the corner, and there's a rainbow. And the end of the rainbow is on the church.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a photo, I'll show you.
Okay.
And I was like, wow, look at that. Isn't that weird? And then we went through a period of a few years of everyone in the family seeing rainbows at the maddest times. Like, might be my mum's birthday. My sister went over to Ireland, played golf with my dad, and there's a rainbow. I've got a tweet thread I'll show you, and it just happened over and over again. It was just the weirdest thing. Anyway, that's a tangent. I think the biggest story of decay is we are watching the world decay at a rapid rate. I mean, we have a revolution appearing to happen in Iran at the moment. We have the black bagging of Maduro in Venezuela, and what does that mean? We have the unfortunate confrontation between ICE agents and the young mother in America, where she ends up dead. We've got endless conflict here. Everyone is at conflict everywhere. We swing from existential crisis to existential crisis. Every political party treats the other one like they are. If they win, it's existential crisis. And whilst that happens, we are slowly, quietly watching the extraction of all wealth upwards from the poorest, the middle class, to the rich. And in doing so, society is just fracturing and decaying itself. A lot of people feel it, but don't see it. We, as Bitcoiners, we know exactly what's happening. We know exactly what's going on. We're trying to tell everyone. But everyone else feels it. But they feel it like it's like a slow decay of their life. Everything just gets a little bit worse all the time. And for me, there's a privilege that comes with it. Because if you recognize it, you can put in place the things to protect yourself and your family. But there's a burden that comes with it. Like, we should be telling everybody about this and helping them escape from this. And we should be holding our political leaders accountable. I was in the coffee shop this morning when I was writing an article called The Age of Confiscation. And I stole the title from a reply somebody put to a tweet this morning from Balaji about what's happening, the like failure of Keynesianism. And I think back to Bastiat's law and what he said with regards to legal plunder. When the state goes from defending property to distribution of property, you invert the morality. So I think the story of decay is a story of the decay of the financial systems of this world, which is decaying everything else. And my lesson from that is that we collectively are cowards to allow this to happen. We're cowards because we vote for narrative. I say we. I don't think a lot of people really truly understand what's happening and how they can stop it. I think if people really understood why the role of the government should be the defense of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness and defense of property. Because if you don't defend that, you will ultimately lead to the destruction of a society, collapse of currencies, collapse of social order. I think people see short term and think, well, it's not great, but if I just vote for that party, that one's going to fix it. And they don't realize it is a feature, not a bug. It is how the system of incentives works. And I feel a burden to try and do whatever I can to teach people about this and influence change.
Me too, but do you think you can tell people that are not ready to listen?
You can try. Uh-huh. You can just try. Sometimes people have to feel it. Argentina had to go through decades of inflation and hyperinflation before they got Milei, mm-hmm. before they were willing to go, I just cannot take this anymore. Give me something else. And Milei came with something else. The only other answer is to become political, but I don't want to be part of a political party who won't fix this. And this is why I don't vote, and I won't vote. And I say to everyone, I'm not voting in the next election because I refuse to vote for decay. That's what I always say. I refuse to vote for decay, and all we're offered right now is decay because no one wants to change the mechanics of the system that is designed to extract upwards, to make the rich richer off the poorest middle class.
Can you work with your enemies?
Enemies? I don't know if I have enemies anymore.
I can't think of a couple.
Yeah, but who would it be and what's the scenario? People would say Craig Wright is my enemy.
Yeah.
But if somebody came to me and said, look, we want to make a film about what happened between you and Craig Wright, would you work with Craig on that? Sure. If my enemy is the government, mm-hmm. and they offer me a job within the government and I want to do it, say I'm offered Bitcoin, head of Bitcoin for the UK government, mm-hmm. and the government is my enemy because I detest the government, would I work with them? Well, if I was given free rein to create the policies that I thought were correct, then fine. But if I had to compromise myself in a way which was net negative for society, no, I couldn't work with them. So I can forget and forgive almost anything. I don't need to hold on to grudges. And if one of my enemies still is an enemy and they want to work with me and the output is something that is net good, then I would do it. I wouldn't work with them to do something that's net negative, but I wouldn't work with a friend to do something net negative. So I don't really think about enemies. And if I have enemies, I'm always happy, have a beer, shake hands, say, what's the issue? Should we figure it out?
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, there's too much conflict at the moment.
Do you worry a lot?
Yes. But not to the point of it damaging my life. More, I would say worry is the wrong term. I think about the bad things that might happen and what can be done about it. I think if you worry too much, you can end up in paralysis and not be able to do anything about it. I mean, I worry about the future for my kids, and I fear God probably more than I believe in him.
Why do you fear him then?
Because if there is, I fear his judgment because perhaps I haven't lived my life in the best way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. What does the perfect Friday night look like for you?
Perfect Friday night for me would be I would pick up my daughter and her boyfriend from school. I'd go home. That would be about 4 o'clock. We'd probably book somewhere nice for dinner, somewhere locally, maybe La Terrazza, my friend Naz's restaurant. We'd head down there. We'd have dinner as a family. I'd have a couple of old fashions. We'd have a good couple of hours together, and then we would go home and I'd find a good film to watch and fall asleep on the couch. That's a good Friday night for me.
What's something you still haven't forgiven yourself for?
This really does make sense now. I don't think there is anything. Yeah. Because, you know, when you asked me about working with my enemies, I said, I don't really have enemies. I'm willing to make up with anyone. I think you have to do that with yourself first. If you don't forgive yourself, you're living in the past and you're allowing depression to come into your life. And I've had depression. And I don't want that back. It was a long time ago. It was hard to beat it. But I did. I regret things, but I can forgive myself for everything. my forgiveness comes through just trying to make amends for things for people. I don't have anything I haven't forgiven myself for.
Great.
You've caught me at a really funny time in my life. this interview was 2 years ago. It'd be so different. It'd be all my ego out there.
So thanks, Pete. Those were my 21 takes on you.
Okay.
Next up, I follow you since before what Bitcoin did.
Back
when you were like a trader with an attitude. I still remember that beach video in Thailand, phone in selfie mode, like the beach behind you. What was the most naive thing you actually believed back then?
Oh, God. I mean, that government was good and necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I've microdosed on red pills since. And it's taken a lot longer than people hoped it would for me to be fully red-pilled. And then I'm orange-pilled and then black-pilled. But I believed government was necessary. I don't know. I believe it's inevitable just because of the way power works and the way humans organize themselves. But I don't think it's necessary. And I believed government operated with good intentions because I believe politicians had good intentions, which is so naive because you can have politicians with all the best intentions in the world. The incentives of the system are such that the road to hell is paved in those good intentions.
Yeah. From beachside trader to podcast king, what would that guy mock you for if he saw you now?
God, these are such good questions. What would he mock me for now? Probably call me a bit of a pussy. Say you've got soft. Come on, man. You're going to take on the world. You're going to be famous and rich. What are you doing? I think you'd mock me for that.
In 2018, I read, reread, and bookmarked that thread of yours about the...
Oh, I know what you're about to tell me, but I made and lost all the money.
About the 2017 bull run and everything that came after. I call it your best of times, worst of times thread.
Mm.
You hit seven figures for the first time, mm-hmm. and for the first time you flew first class.
Mm-hmm.
You bought a good watch, some great clothes, and you told us, for the next cycle, buy some good experiences and nice things, because those would be the only souvenirs left after the crash. Your mom died, you overdosed. What made you share all of that pain so openly?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know why I shared it. Probably.
Did you write that thread for us or for yourself?
Probably both. Probably both. I mean, it's hard to really remember the intentions at the time.
Yeah.
I tend to write when I have thoughts, and I just tend to write, whether it's a thread, a tweet, or an article.
I think you said something like you went from around 120 to 80 Bitcoin buying shit coins before realizing what you were doing.
Slightly different. So what happened was so this was after the year of running.
Yeah.
And so it was just before my mum died. So just about, I don't know, 9 years ago, that would have been to start of 2017. I had about £35,000 left. And then I'd be cooked. That's it. All I had. My advertising agency had failed. My marriage had collapsed. Mum was dying. All of that stuff. And I'd been coming off the drugs. So I bought something like 7 Bitcoin, and then a load of ETH, and then loads of shit coins. And then 2017, I just traded through that whole year, and I peaked at, I don't know. I used to have this spreadsheet where I had every shitcoin, its value in pounds, dollars, and Bitcoin. And it was about 186 Bitcoin, which I wish I had now. And I think it peaked over a million, so 1.2, 1.3 million. And I was like, this is amazing. I'm a genius. When really it's just like anything you bought would go up. That was it. You go to bed, you wake up, it's like I made another 50 grand. I'm such a genius. You weren't a genius. And I remember I took the kids to a place called Center Parks at Christmas, and my dad came. And my dad was saying, look, sell some of those and buy some property, like anchor it in. I was like, yeah, no, I'll do that. And I was sitting there on my laptop. My daughter came running over, had a glass of wine. She knocked it over. She was only 4, and it fried my laptop. I was like, I'll do it when I get back. And anyway, we get back in January, and there was that big crash. And then eventually I had to sell some Bitcoin. All the shitcoins went to and then I had to pay my tax. So I had to sell some Bitcoin. And I think I ended up with about 18 Bitcoin or something at that point. No other money. And my net worth was like under 60 grand. And I was like, I've gone from 35 to there, back to 60. But do you know what's so weird? I never felt bad about losing the money. There was no part of me that was like, oh my God, I've lost all this money. This is awful. Because I don't think it ever felt real. Like I bought the watch, I bought a car, I flew business class. I was having a great time. I can't explain it, but there was never like a... I think some people, when they lose a lot of money, it can really affect them. I think some people take their lives. Well, we know they do. I mean, the big crypto crash recently. I don't know. I was just like, all right, so be it.
Yeah, I'll make it again. That's what you said.
Yeah, I'll make it again. And I started the podcast back in, I'd done my first interview in November 2017. And so I was like, I'll just do the podcast. And yeah, I mean, if I think back to the thread, because the thread just blew up.
Yeah. It was really personal.
Yeah, but I think it was useful because I clearly wasn't the only one. I mean, not everyone, but the vast majority of people wrote it up and then wrote it down. And I think sometimes when you write something like that, you are given a gift to other people to go, oh, I'm not the only one. This has happened. But yeah, I can't really remember the intentions. It was funny. The best of times, the worst of times. That's what it was called. Isn't that... best of times, the worst. Is that Dickens?
Yeah, Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
Is there anything you wish you had included or something you wish you hadn't?
Yeah, so overdose is probably the wrong word to use. I had something called an SVT. Maybe at the time I thought I had, but what I triggered is something called an SVT. I was probably just being dramatic. I triggered something called an SVT. It's where the electrical pulses in your heart just start firing. So my heart rate went up to 200 beats per minute, and then ended up in hospital and got a Tylenol for a doctor. And then I had multiple SVTs over the next few months, and that's why I had to deal with all the mental health issues.
What did you learn about people and about yourself during those hardest days?
Drug addiction sucks. I know what rock bottom is like. I remember the moment where I knew I was at rock bottom. It's a really strange experience. So I remember there was one evening, I was at home on my own, called up my dealer, got some coke, I was drinking. And I used to just sit there and do coke all night on my own, night after night, like a loser. And I remember one night I was doing the coke, and when you do cocaine, you have a buzz. So say you're here, you go up here, and when you come down, you go below there, right? And there's like this agitated, horrible feeling. So you do another line, you get above and above. It was the only time I ever had it where I did cocaine. I never got above the line. I only felt crap. And every time I did a line, I just got back to normal. And I was like, I don't even feel high. I feel shit. I feel terrible. I feel shit. And then I got in the shower, trying to calm myself down, trying to get into bed to sleep, but my heart was racing. And I was like, this is awful. I didn't know I was going to get through the night. It was definitely one of those ones I thought, well, is this how someone dies? I remember laying there thinking, is this how someone dies? Like someone's just going to find my body tomorrow and some cocaine residue, and I'm just some loser who died doing cocaine on his own. So I can reflect upon that time and what a pathetic loser I'd become. Terrible person. They talk about with addiction there's a lot of shame. There are stories I will never tell that I know of, which are very shameful about my behavior that time as an addict. It's funny because I've been watching this Dope Sick series about the opioid crisis. And you see certain behaviors of yourself in that, and I'm so glad I got away from it all, but it could have really got bad. Like a lot worse than it did, because when you're an addict, you're very selfish. You're not really thinking about, you're just thinking about yourself. And I would go to work, get through the day, go home, get high. And it's just this cycle of crap. But I can't honestly tell you what I learned about other people during that period, because that period was just about me being a loser. People are willing to help, but the other thing is people have got their own shit going on as well.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I haven't talked about this for a long time, and it feels almost doesn't feel real because it was so long ago. Yeah, my life's so different now. Like, I haven't done drugs in, I can't even remember, years and years and years. And I used to be an animal for drugs, for cocaine. And I just, even the thought of it, just like, think it's gross. And so I don't recognize that anymore. But it was just a very, there was a 2-year period, which was truly awful. Maybe longer. 2014 to 2016. It was just dreadful. I know people were there for me. Of course they were, family, friends. But also sometimes they have to give up on you. Like, I've had to give up on some people who just cannot be helped. You kind of have to go and find it yourself.
This episode is brought to you by BitBox, the Bitcoin hardware wallet that guards your sovereignty. The Bitcoin-only BitBox 02 Nova is Swiss-built, intuitive, fully open source, comes with a micro SD card, and is protected by a secure element. So keep your Bitcoin on your BitBox offline and safe where it belongs. Go to bitbox.swiss and use code ALLINBITCOIN for 5% off, or check the show notes. Could you tell me a story about your mom?
When we were kids, my mom's an incredible woman. When we were kids, she wanted to teach us to swim. And she didn't have a car. My dad had the car to go to work, and we used to live in Kempston down the road, and the swim pool was up here, so it's a good 2-3 miles away. And she used to take us every Saturday swimming. I would be on the little basket on the back. My sister was sat on my front, and my brother on a little bike next to him. She used to take us all the way there, teach us to swim, because she insists on us learning to swim, and take us all the way back. And at the time, you don't think about it now. But right now, you think about it. It's like, if I take my kids to swim, we get in our Range Rover and we would drive to the pool. Yeah, there was a different kind of hardship then. When we'd go shopping, my mum had a budget, and that was it. It was £50. Say it was £50. She'd fill the trolley. She's hit. That's done. We'll go home. When we go, we just get what we want and buy it. My mum just always got on with things. She didn't complain. She didn't expect anything. She didn't want anything. She wanted time with my dad. Actually, I will tell you a funny story about my mum. She didn't have a filter.
Okay.
That was her only big problem. My dad tells me at this time, they were on a cruise. Yeah, because my dad's aircraft engineer won't fly, figure that. And my mum wanted to see the world when they retired. So they did 2 world cruises. Mm-hmm. And when you go to dinner, apparently, I've not been on one, but you go to dinner, it's the same people every night, you get to know them. Anyway, they got there this first night. My dad says, the couple next to them, the wife was a big woman. And apparently, as they sat down to eat, this big woman started talking to my mum. She said, oh, yeah, this cruise is going to be difficult because, you know, I've been on a diet. Yeah, and I've lost a lot of weight. And my mum turned around to her and said, well, how big were you? And that's the kind of thing my mum would say, because she just didn't understand. She didn't have a filter. So my dad's like dying inside. but yeah, she just got on with life. When after she died, I went down to the hospital where she worked. She worked in the children's ward. And I offered to volunteer. I just felt like I needed to do it. Mm-hmm. So I volunteered in the hospital for three months, going 2-3 times a week and just play with the kids or get the parents cups of tea and stuff. I remember I was there one time, one of the nurses said, come on, let me show you something. And she took me to the back room, which is where for the families and the parents. And mm-hmm. she said, we wanted to redecorate this room, but we didn't have any money. And so your mum just came in one weekend and did it. And it was like, it was all painted. There was like a stencil all around the top, and said, yeah, your mum just went around and stenciled this all around the top. Mm-hmm. That's just typical mum. Most people would just be like, oh, there's no budget, I'm not doing it. My mum was like, okay. She went and got some paint and just did it. That's who she was.
Yeah. What are the non-negotiables in your life today? What won't you compromise anymore?
What non-negotiable? I mean, outside of the obvious ones, like which we would all have. I listened to a podcast recently with Chris Williamson and Naval. And Naval was saying, if he doesn't want to reply to an email, he doesn't anymore. He's like, you've come into my space. I just don't have to reply. And so when I go through my emails, I get a lot of requests, especially locally. I just delete stuff now. It's just like, I don't need to reply to this. I don't owe you a reply. I don't owe you an apology for not being able to help with whatever it is you need. So I guess my non-negotiable right now is my time. Like, there's two scarce things in life, time and Bitcoin. All right.
In that order.
But there's a Chinese adage, which is an inch of time is worth an inch of gold. An inch of gold cannot buy an inch of time. Like, I heard that years ago, and I think about it a lot. And I think about it in context of somebody like Steve Jobs, richest guy in the world, gets cancer. He has a ticking time clock there. He had all the money in the world. It did not matter. His cancer could not be cured. And so if time is so valuable, but you cannot buy more time, you should really treasure every minute of every day. So I try now to only do the things I want. You sent me a lovely email. I was like, I'm doing this. You want to come to my town all the way here? Of course I want to give you this time. And I'm even more glad I've done it now we've done it. Even though this is going to be so embarrassing and people are going to make fun of me for a minute, I'm like really glad I did it. This is quite therapeutic and it's a lovely conversation. And I'm not entirely there, but my non-negotiable, my only ambition left is to have every minute of every day non-negotiable. I still have to commit to things I don't want to do because, you know, commitments. But I want to get rid of all those commitments and make my time my non-negotiable.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
How good are you at admitting when you're wrong?
I'm a lot better now. I think of pretty much this is what this has been about.
Yeah.
I actually think admitting you're wrong is a superpower. It's a real superpower because you completely disarm somebody. When somebody comes at you, I go, yeah, I was wrong. He can't get an argument from me. It's like, well, where do you want to go from here? I was wrong. I did it wrong. I'm sorry. He either has to like go, oh, okay. Well, do you want a beer?
Yeah.
Or he has to find something else to be angry at me about. And so I think admitting you're wrong is a superpower. Yeah. It comes along with ego death and kind of like a stoic approach to life that you cannot let anyone, they can throw barbs at you and they can't stick onto you. And it's a real superpower. It comes with that kind of living in the present. But I also think if you are certain you're right, you should defend your position. But it's really good to start from a point of, could I be wrong? Like, could I be wrong in this scenario? And so, like, with general life stuff, I try and be better at admitting I'm wrong. I'm actually really bad at it with my son. My son, that's a weird thing you go through. Like, my son's, like, in his 20s now. And he is much better at reading parts of life than I am. And he comes to me and says, Dad, like, he calls me out. And I'm like, no. And I've had to get a lot better at recognizing that, you know what, he's right. He calls me out on my bullshit and he's right. And I've had to become better at that. But generally speaking, with life stuff, I think I'm a lot better at it. When it's like, I don't know, economic, political arguments on Twitter, I don't know if I'm as good at admitting I'm wrong or questioning whether I could be wrong. But I would say to most people, most of us are wrong about a lot of stuff all the time. Try admitting it. It's a superpower.
Yeah. Looking back, would you agree that some of your sponsors turn out to be bad actors and that people who trusted you might have lost money because of it?
Yeah, good questions, because I got a lot of criticism from this. So I never took a sponsorship where I thought they were a bad actor or it was a bad product. BlockFi was my most known one. John Carvalho warned me early on. I was like, you're wrong. I had money in BlockFi. I thought it was great. I was getting my interest. I was like, what do you want about? And then they raised, I think they got up to their E round. I believed in it.
Yeah, there was this minor company. I can't remember.
I remember. I can't remember their name. But they failed because of the CEO of the business. BlockFi could have continued. Look at Ledin. Ledin is doing great. BlockFi failed because of the way they generated their yield, which was quite opaque. But they were doing well for years. That mining company, again, failed because of their CEO. It was a good business. It failed because the CEO was useless. And in the Bitcoin world, we're in like a niche community of products and things. But companies fail all the time. Products fail all the time. I never once accepted a sponsorship from a product I wouldn't use myself. And so I use BlockFi. I use that mining company. I bought 5 of their S19 Pros, I think it was. The wallet I had that where the guy went to jail, I use that wallet. But perhaps I didn't heed the warnings enough. I think the main one's BlockFi. I didn't heed the warnings enough. And yeah, I got that wrong. But I accept no responsibility for people who've lost money because we all have agency. And I think when you blame a podcast host for selling an ad more than you blame the CEO of a company... I mean, I took way more shit than the CEOs of these companies because I took an ad sponsorship from a legal company, a regulated company. So I always rejected that. You have agency. When you go and use a product, you have a choice to research it yourself and say whether you want to use it. You have agency. You can look up the risks. So no, I don't accept any responsibility because I don't want to take agency away from people.
It's true.
But it doesn't mean I'm sad about it. I don't have regret. Anyone who lost money on BlockFi, do you know what the worst thing on BlockFi was? Is that they pulled their sponsorship just a few months before they did the deal with Sam, what's his name, who went to jail.
Sam Bankman-Fried.
Yeah. And so what happened was Ledin wanted to take over the sponsorship. So I was like, okay. So Ledin became the sponsor. So I moved my Bitcoin out of BlockFi and into Ledin. And then they went into administration. And from the outside world, it looks like, inside knowledge, hey, Pete. Yeah, you moved yours out and didn't warn anyone. Because people, they default to assume the worst. But no, it was, I always used the products of the companies I accept sponsorship from. I met with Zach. They couldn't afford the sponsorship anymore. They asked to poll. I spoken to Mao at Ledin. He said, yeah, I'd love to sponsor you. So I just moved. And then it turns out the deal with Sam was a complete fraud for them to steal the remaining Bitcoin and money, and people got screwed. But yeah, I think it's really important to blame the people who were the architects of what went wrong, not the guy who was asked, can I advertise your product? Yeah, you can advertise my product. I think it's an unfair way people shift blame. What is the responsibility of a podcaster? You know, should I have known that BlockFi was going to go administration? Well, the knowledge I had from the company is, no, we're fine. Now we're not fine. We can't sponsor you. Oh, now we've done a deal with Sam. We're going to be fine. Like, I don't know. I don't have access to their P&L or their... cash flow. I don't know. Our relationship is, can we have an ad? Yeah, we can have an ad, and it will pay your invoice. So, but it does mean, like, people don't know about all the ads I rejected.
Yeah.
My God, I've rejected, in terms of value, more ads than I've taken on.
Yeah.
The shitcoin sponsors, the money those people have, the deals I got offered, 7-figure deals for shitcoins. Could have made a fortune, but I didn't, because one, I don't believe in shit coins, and two, they weren't right for the audience. I took the ones that I think were right, but I rejected a lot.
I remember you posted your first and second year numbers for what Bitcoin did, until I think American HODL and a few others told you to stop sharing your finances.
Yes.
At the time, I thought, that's Pete, your transparency.
Yeah,
I think
transparent.
It was a very big part of your success. I think the other part was really hard work.
Well, I used to share the finances every month, the income, the outgoing, to be fully transparent.
Yeah.
And when I started it, I wasn't really making any money. And then it got to the period where I was like, oh, this looks like good money. And American HODL said, you've put a target on your back. Do you want some crazy numbers? So at its peak, when the podcast was seven people working on it, because it was me, Danny, Ben, my brother, an assistant, somebody else. And then we were traveling the world as a team with a camera crew. It cost $1.5 million to run the show.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
So you'd have to make more than $1.5 million to make a profit. At its peak year, it generated over $3 million in revenue. So there was, I mean, there was a couple of years where it did really well. But the first year I ran it, I lost money. I didn't have a sponsor for the first year. I lost money because I flew everywhere, all at my own cost. Probably, I don't know, a couple $100,000 or $100,000. I can't remember the numbers. We're talking 9 years ago. And then when I got my first sponsor, I was nearly broke. I was about to lose my house. I needed renewing my mortgage. I didn't have any money. I did a job interview with, I think, with Kraken and another company in America, and I turned them down. And then I got a phone call, got offered a sponsorship contract. And then it started making money. But that year, like, it brought revenue in. But again, it didn't make a profit for, I don't think, its first 3 years, maybe. Then a little bit, then some more. And then I had a couple of years where we did very well. But I was in a lawsuit with Craig Wright. And so all those profits, yeah, well, not all of them, a lot of them went into paying the legal fees. I got some support from some other people. And it was making good money at the point I decided not to do what Bitcoin did anymore. And so it's a complicated business model. It's very hard to make money of it, and you have to work very hard.
For a few years, you trolled and got trolled heavily on Twitter.
I still troll.
At one point, it even sent you to the emergency room, if I recall correctly. Is there anyone you genuinely regret going after?
I can regret general behavior, but I don't know if I regret going after anyone. I have like a weird relationship with Twitter in that each troll post, it's like having a cigarette. I don't smoke anymore, but I remember when I wanted to stop smoking. I still had the odd cigarette. I didn't have the cigarette, enjoy it, and then afterwards I'd feel dirty. I feel like that with Twitter sometimes. Like there's a pleasure in the moment of owning somebody, and then you feel dirty afterwards.
You have taken holidays.
Yeah, I have, and I have these battles with it where I'm like, just, are you doing good? You know, is what you're doing, is the way you tweet at people? Sometimes I try and be more constructive. See a reply and try and give it like an intellectual answer to it. And then other times I just call people a fucking moron. And then afterwards I'm like, oh, why did you do that? Like, what have you gained from this? And how have you let other people in the world perceive you? I think my Twitter behavior is, there's like a gap between who I am in real life and who I am online. But I think it's kind of the same. I just don't think the Britishness of how I tweet comes across. It looks really hostile. Really, it's the way I would talk to my mates in the pub. Some people have come after me in a very nasty, threatening way before. I've had death threats. I had one guy troll me about my mother after she passed in the most dreadful way. And then, you know, if you start to do well, some people build their status on attacking you. And so you get reply guys who come after you, and I've been a reply guy as well. I'm never sure how healthy it really is, but I don't think I've gone after anyone in a malicious way. I don't think I've looked at someone and gone, I'm coming after you.
Tell us how you experienced the COVID era and what made you rethink things.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think that was my black pill moment. So when it first happened, I started making documentaries, and there was like a news report in Turkey that Erdogan was sending refugees to the border with Greece because there's so many refugees in Turkey, so many immigrants, because Turkey is the gateway to Europe. And Erdogan had enough of it. And I was like, I think I need to go and see what this is. So I phoned up a sponsor and said, I need to go. Can you give me 10 grand to go and make a film? They said, yes. And it looked like we were just about to close down from COVID. I was like, I've got to go today. So I booked the flight, went out to these refugee camps, made the film, and I came back into the first lockdown. So, and I think I got COVID because I was so ill when I got back. I was in such a terrible way. I felt awful. one of the most ill I've ever felt. But you couldn't get tested. They were only at that point testing people who'd been to China or Italy because they were the two hotspots. So I couldn't get tested. So I got ill and I got better. And then I had this second podcast called Defiance. I interviewed a doctor I know, a friend of mine I went to school with, and he was telling a story, and he got emotional. He was crying during it. But he told this story of how they had some people come in with COVID. It was a trickle, and then it was a flood, and then they had to declare emergency, and people couldn't breathe, and they were dying. And so at the point the government announced the lockdown, I was fully supportive of it. I put out this tweet that, on reflection, looks stupid. I was like, I support draconian measures. You know, we need to stop the spread and blah, blah, blah. I fell for the whole thing without thinking about it critically. And at the point when the vaccines came out, I was like, yeah, give me that vaccine. Absolutely. Didn't think about it. I even went to get the vaccine, I thought everyone was being ludicrous. I mean, every time I go on holiday, I have vaccines. And so I didn't think much about it. I didn't have this like skepticism of the medical establishment, because the NHS is a little bit different than profit driven markets. And my mum was a nurse. So I went and got it, and I was making fun of people who were scared of it. I was like, what are you scared of? It's just a vaccine. And then what happened was, after the first lockdown, they wanted to do the second lockdown. I was like, oh, this is ridiculous. This doesn't work. The lockdowns haven't worked. What's going to happen is, if you keep people locked down, every time you open up, it's clearly going to spread again. So you can't stop a virus. And then I wanted to take my daughter to New York for her birthday. And I booked the flights, the hotel, and tickets to go and see Billie Eilish at Madison Square Gardens, because I think she liked her. And we didn't have to get a vaccine to travel because she was 11 and it was 12 that you required it. But in New York, she needed a vaccine to get into Madison Square Gardens. I was like, I started looking into the vaccine. I was like, there's no way she's getting this. And then the information was coming out. And then it just, over a period of time, I was like, shit, I got this all wrong. The whole thing. And it's not that I think government was malicious. I think it was incompetence, lying, and then malicious sections of both the government and the medical establishment that enriched people through this. It kind of became that moment where I was like, lifted the veil and everything. I was like, yeah, these people, you cannot trust the individuals and you cannot trust the system. The incentives, again, are in such a way that it was only natural that the medical companies would find a way of profiteering off this. And now I have to live knowing I've had this vaccine, which I fully regret. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad I didn't allow my daughter to have it, but I'm very glad that I didn't do it. And then since then, I've had zero trust in government, politicians, the mechanics of the state since. And it's been a very painful thing to walk through, because even now, I mean, we're years down the line, and I'll tweet about something and there'll be a reply and it's a picture of me getting my vaccine, or it's, weren't you a COVID guy? And I was like, yeah, I was. I got it wrong. I apologize. I made a mistake. And to anyone I made fun of, I'm sorry, because I made a mistake. I'm owning my mistake, but I can't go and undo it. So look, if somebody wants to hate me for the rest of my life because of that, so be it. That's their choice. That's their life. All I can do is recognize a mistake I made and own it and apologize for it. But when I was making the podcast, I think that's something people can't appreciate, is that I didn't start the podcast as like a libertarian or an anarchist. I started as just a normie, like a normie from Bedford who was getting over a drug addiction and a separation from his wife, who discovered Bitcoin because of his drug addiction, not because he was against the Bank of England. And just started a podcast and then lived in a bubble for years where I would go and meet Danny and would get a hotel or an Airbnb and we'd make shows and I'd go home. I wasn't really living in that place where I was like fully skeptical of the state and understanding the state. What happened was after the podcast, when I decided to no longer do what Bitcoin did and I came back here to the UK and Bedford and to embed myself in the community and try to make change, that I just came up against obstacle after obstacle after obstacle, and then really started to understand the problems with the state. But I lived in a bubble. And there's a lot of normies out there like me who fell for all this shit. And it's really sad that that happened, but it did. Can't undo it. It's, you know, that's part of whatever my journey, the cringe term journey is. It's part of my journey.
What's the most important thing you've learned through osmosis on what Bitcoin did from all the OGs?
It's not just via osmosis, it's via direct experience. But I've just learned that we have a financial system that, and a set of incentives that extracts money from the poorest and the middle class upwards. And that comes from a weakness in the political system, in that we aren't constitutionally protected from this. It goes back to what I said about Bastiat and the law, in that the state's purpose is to defend life, liberty, property. And if it's the American Constitution and the pursuit of happiness, which is tied to those, that's their job. To defend your life, your freedom, and your property. And the minute that government goes beyond that and becomes a mechanism for distribution, morality is inversed. And at that point, you will always have a uniparty, because the uniparty's job is to win the levers of power, which is the levers of money creation, the levers of regulation, and the levers of infringement upon all your rights, which is essentially an infringement on life, liberty, and property. And so that's what I've learned. And the only world I want to live in the future is one where a government defends those three principles, and we don't have that. And that's what I've learned. And it's by osmosis, it's by people directly telling me, it's by the experience of coming up against that system.
You learned about libertarianism in Austrian economics, life on air in front of thousands of people, and never pretended otherwise.
Yes.
What's the most embarrassing, I used to believe this moment, you are willing to admit right now?
There's just not one. There's so many moments. There's moments of being told. There's moments of reading. There's moments of experience. COVID was one of them. Trying to hear, just in Bedford, trying to make Bedford a more economically prosperous and safer place, I came up against the machine of the state. And it's not just the state itself. It's those who do its bidding. All those people who defend the mechanics of the state now, the people who vote for a party because they believe it's virtuous and that party's intentions are good and they're going to fix the problems in society. Coming against that's been the biggest lesson, because unless we get the mechanics right, we're going to be stuck forever in this doom loop of extracting money up to the richest and most powerful people. Because legally, we've engineered it to be that. Unless we engineer it to be the opposite, then I refuse to be part of that and vote within that system. I'm very direct now and determined in my views. I used to think about libertarians, people like Eric Voorhees, and say, oh, it's fucking bullshit. Like, it's never going to be that. A little bit of welfare is good. You're so, and I'm like, no, you have to hold an absolute firm ground. Now, you cannot give an inch on this. The minute the state goes from defending life, liberty, and property to distribution, you are setting a country and a society on a path of decay. And so my position won't be moved. I will not become an MP, and I will not support a party that doesn't restore those basic principles of what the state should do.
The Cry Right lawsuit dragged on for 6 years.
Yeah.
I remember you were 40 when you wrote that open letter to Craig and you signed it. Peter McCormack, 40. He had an army of lawyers and you had yourself.
Oh, what a mistake.
It hospitalized you a few times and it almost bankrupted you.
Yes.
What did you learn from that period?
Oh, a lot. The being right and honest doesn't matter with lawfare. Yes, ultimately I won, but I got very lucky. That money and power is sometimes, how do I put this? You can be more successful with money and power than you can be with being truthful, honest, and moral. that the good guy doesn't always win. But again, this is downstream of a system that doesn't defend life, liberty, and property. Because if it defended life, liberty, and property, it would defend free speech, and therefore I would never have been in this legal position. You can weaponize the law, legal system to drain somebody into defeat. So you win by virtue of having enough money to drag a process on that you bankrupt somebody. But you don't win the argument, you just win the process. And the law shouldn't be about winning the process, it should be about winning the argument. And that's why the surface area of what litigation should cover should be as small as possible. It should be contract disputes, fraud, violence, those things which we as individuals can do to others, which harm their lives. And words are not violence. Anyone who says they are a moron. It's funny, everything we talk about here, it all just comes back to the same points. It's all coming back to the role of the state and what the state enables. And the state now is just a behemoth of corruption, immorality, greed, manipulation, because it has a large surface area. I mean, what we've seen in Minnesota with daycare centers, that is downstream from a state with a large surface area, which provides distribution systems that can be grifted. If that distribution system didn't happen, there would be no free daycare centers that could exploit that system and extract money out via corruption, which is theft from the taxpayer.
Life is an irony. Roger Ver once believed Craig Wright was Satoshi.
Yes.
Then publicly split from him during the Bcash Satoshi Vision fiasco. Later, he offered to pay you your legal settlement against Craig.
Not my settlement. He offered to pay towards my legal fees.
Your legal fees.
I made a settlement offer to Craig. Mm-hmm. So a few months before the final judgment, it looked like I was going to lose. And it would have bankrupted me. And we went through what the bankrupting procedure would mean, which would be all my businesses sold. My house would have been sold after a year. I wouldn't have been able to be a director for a company for 7 years. I would have been bankrupt. It would have affected me deeply and my kids. So I made him an offer, which was all the money I had. I said, take everything. Just let me keep my house and my kids, because that's what we need to, yeah, so I can be a father. And he said no. He wanted to destroy my life.
Who else would you like to thank for stepping up?
There are three people specifically who helped financially. But I wouldn't name them publicly. But at the very start, two people helped me out. And then there was a point where I was going to have to pull. I was just going to have to admit defeat. One person specifically, I reached out. And they know, if they listen to this, they'll know exactly who they are. And without them, I would have been bankrupted and lost. And Craig would have won. But because we could carry the case on, it got me through a tough period. We were able to defeat him. So that was not only important to me and my family, but to the wider Bitcoin community. So I'm not going to name them. But there's loads of other people who supported me, like Danny. Danny was like my hero during it, because he absorbed a lot of the pressure that I was under. It was rough, and he absorbed so much of that pressure for me. And so I thank him deeply for that.
Who shocked you by staying silent?
I think that there were a lot of people who were affected by this, who were facing lawsuits, who were being pressured and having their lives destroyed. I was able to get through it because I had the podcast, so I had the income. So when I was making all that good money, it was fine. But when I was getting, you know, I was getting invoices for 50 grand, 80 grand, 100 grand from the lawyers, I had to pay. And so I could do it. I just never had any money. There are other people who didn't. But there are people in the world of Bitcoin, billionaires. They've made phenomenal amounts of money. And I think they could have stepped up and helped people, but for whatever reason, they chose not to. And that's their choice. But I'd like to think if I was in that scenario, I would help. I mean, I've done things. I've donated money and helped people in lots of different ways when I can. And I would like to think I would have.
Yeah. What do you feel when you think of Craig Wright today?
I don't feel much anymore. Mm-hmm. Like have I forgiven him? I think so. Like, despite everything, I think I've forgiven him, which is why I don't care anymore. Like, I don't, like, he's cost me financially a lot of money. I never got back. Cost me a lot of stress. I ended up in hospital, I think, 3 times just with those SVTs that were triggered by stress from this. It affected my family, my son, certainly, my dad, deeply. And that was his choice, based on a lie, to go out and try and destroy my life for whatever reason he wanted to do that. But I don't want to hold on to that anymore. I haven't for a long time. So I've forgiven, I guess, but I mainly have pity for him. Like, you know, when you make decisions in life where you know you're lying, and in the act of that lie, you are damaging someone's life severely, and you go home at night and you have your dinner and you look in the mirror and you go to bed and you live with that lie, knowing you're affecting somebody's life. What has become of you to be that person? And so I don't know if he's a psychopath or he's got deep trauma, he's just narcissistic, whichever version that is. But like, I'm free as a human. I live a free life. I'm content. I'm happy. I've got everything I could possibly want in the world. I'm so lucky. I'm not running towards anything anymore, and I'm not running away from anything. I am, after this, I'm going to go and play tennis, and it's great. And he doesn't get to live that life. He's running away from whatever he's running away from and trying to run towards something else. And he's never going to have that peace. If he's a narcissist, he'll never feel true love, because you can't love if you're a narcissist. It's not within you. Like, you're functionally unable to feel and give love. And I've loved and been loved. And it's the most beautiful thing, right? And he can't do that. So he's punished for the eternity of life without the ability to experience love. He faces a life of purgatory outside of the world of love that others get to experience. And that sounds really kind of soppy, but it's true. You know, if you don't get to experience real love in life, I've experienced it and I've lost it, and it's something to treasure when you have it. If you don't get to experience that, that's really sad. So I don't hold any deep feelings towards him beyond pity. Like, what a sad existence that is. I don't know. I don't think about it much anymore. It's a chapter in the history of Bitcoin. I don't know. Chapter 6 is Craig Wright, and how ultimately he just lost. He lost. We beat him. We collectively beat him, and he's done, and he's gone. And that's it.
That's where I left off with Peter, but wait until you hear what he admits in part 2, dropping February 11th. Make sure to subscribe and hit the bell so you don't miss it.